All right. Well, we're continuing our series in Christian Living and Thought, and tonight we're taking up the issue of pacifism and just war. The reason we take up a topic like this is not just for curious minds, but it has to do with the fact that we understand that we must live in this world, in the present, and we must put into practice the things that the Scripture would say. We have to deal with real life and real questions and real issues. And so we bring our obedience to Christ and our understanding of that He has given His Word as a sure guide for us for the decisions that we would make in life. So we take up issues like this and ask the question, what does the Scripture say? So I just kind of laid out the issue there in that opening paragraph on the handout. Is it permissible for Christians to participate in national warfare or in personal self-defense, even, based on Jesus' teaching to turn the other cheek? We find in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:39 and following, and he says also in Romans 12, Paul says, not to seek your own revenge. And, additional question, if it's generally permissible to engage in national warfare as a Christian or personal self-defense, are there any conditions or limitations placed on such participation? And this question extends to questions whether capital punishment is acceptable, whether a Christian can serve as a soldier or police officer or a head of state, even one who would declare war. Sincere and careful Christians throughout the centuries have wrestled with this question, and it's not an idle question. Is it permissible? Does the Lord want us to live in and do certain things? We have to make decisions about life like this. I think especially this question has become important in the 20th century, because the 20th century was filled with warfare, not so much that it's different from other centuries, but the nature of the warfare in the 20th century, especially the latter parts of the 20th century, has changed what warfare entails. And so it's brought the question all up again. The type of warfare that we engage in now, is that permissible? And so it bears on asking the kind of question, especially also, I think the question becomes much more pertinent to us as Christians, as really there is a religious war once again, after many centuries of lack of religious wars, at least on a global scale, there is a religious war going on, particularly with the Islamic State, seeking to establish a religious war all around the world. If that war comes very close to us, will we fight that war? Or should we not fight, like combat, against that? Tonight we're going to deal solely with the question of warfare, trusting that you can take it from there and answer the questions for yourself as they take those principles and relate and apply them to capital punishment, personal self-defense, etc. We're just going to take up the issue of warfare. A couple of options, and I'll just note the first footnote there under the options. John Feinberg, in his book Ethics for a Brave New World, he lays out really good the historical positions that Christians have taken. So I borrowed from his book quite a bit. Let's talk about pacifism for a minute. It really is pacifism, and the position means being passive and seeking to pacify rather than to engage in any kind of violent activity. It comes from placing a high priority on Jesus' teaching about turning the other cheek when attacked, and therefore nations and individuals should respond with this ethic as a high priority, entrusting themselves to the Lord personally to deal with the evil in this world. Several positions have been put forward over the year, and I think we need to understand them. Four different positions here on pacifism. One is universal pacifism, and this means that violence and killing are always wrong by anyone for any reason. So that would eliminate capital punishment. That would eliminate any kind of self-defense for an attacker on you. Obviously, would eliminate war itself. Okay, so that's one position. Universal pacifism. Christian pacifism. Christians are never to resort to violence, but it's acceptable for unbelievers. So some would say that the scriptures would would bind Christians, but not necessarily bind anyone and everyone. It's not always wrong. It's just wrong for Christians to engage in any kind of violent resistance. Then there is private pacifism. So in other words, there are those who would say personal violence is always wrong. You always turn the other cheek personally, but nations need not turn the other cheek because God has given them a different set of instructions. They can enact justice or conduct wars. But this position, private pacifism, would generally eliminate Christians serving in a violent capacity in those wars. Okay, and then there is just generally an anti-war pacifism. Personal violence or personal self-defense may at times be justified, but not national wars. Okay, so there's just various positions on pacifism, and we'll evaluate those as we look at some of the theological considerations here. Then there's the other general position, and that is just war, or you might say just peacemaking. I'm not saying just in the sense of, you know, kind of, oh, it's just a war, you know, not that kind of just, but just as in justice, engaging in a just war or engaging in what Feinberg terms just peacemaking, seeking for peace. So here's the basic position. War ought to be avoided and yet ultimately is unavoidable if, in fact, evil is to be restrained or resisted in a fallen world. And yet it must be engaged in, one, only for just purposes. So war is permissible, but engaged in only for just purposes. And two, in a just way. So the way you wage warfare has to be a just way. This has been the basic position of Christianity throughout the centuries. Probably most earliest, you know, position was put forward by Augustine back in the 4th century. So in order for a Christian to engage in active combat in national war, both conditions would have to apply. There, it would have to be a just war that's being waged by their nation, and they would have to engage in it in a just way. This is the position of just war, just peacemaking. Some theological considerations as we compare these options, whether pacifism of some sort versus just war and just peacemaking. One, man. We need to understand man's condition. We're depraved, we're sinful, we're limited in knowledge. Okay, the scripture teaches that very plainly. We're finite. Therefore, any war might be avoided, like any sin might be avoided, theoretically. But it's unrealistic to eliminate all war. We read a few weeks ago from Micah chapter 3, that one day they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nation will not lift up nation against sword against nation. But when will that happen? When the one who is our peace comes and establishes that kind of peace. Until that time, there will be wars. Daniel even prophesies, until the time of the Messiah, there will be wars. We need to understand the state, okay, the nation, the national entity. The state is ordained by God to bear the sword, Romans 13, Genesis 9, actually, against evil. Part of the function of the state is to restrain evil. That's what God has assigned the position to the state to do, including any evil attack that would come against a state. What about the church? The church is not a theocracy. Okay, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. The church doesn't have a political agenda, but the church does have a duty to participate in a basic way in building a just and peaceful society. We are a part of this world, and we have a part in living in this world, and as we can, participating in an orderly, just, peaceful society. Some verses there that would allow for that and even call for that. Romans 13, owe nothing to any man except to love one another. Is it loving to allow injustice and evil to reign? Okay. The second coming, just as we consider the second coming, we've been looking at that in Revelation. It is certainly a violent, warring kind of affair that Jesus comes and establishes peace, but it is a just affair. We need to understand killing versus murder. Okay? Killing someone else versus murdering someone else. In the Scripture and in the language of the Scripture, those two things are not the same thing. The godliest of Old Testament saints in the Old Testament killed. Okay, just because Old Testament saints did something doesn't necessarily make it right. But Abraham, Joshua, David, Elijah, even others, Samson, etc., in Hebrews 11, killed and seemed to be, there's no condemnation upon them for that particular act as they killed in war or as an official act of government against foreign nations. Also, the sixth commandment, thou shalt not kill, is what older translations say. More modern translations have recognized the way in which that can be interpreted wrongly, and most have changed it to thou shalt not murder. That's the actual intent of the Hebrew word, thou shalt not murder, because in the very next chapter and throughout the Old Testament law, all sorts of times the people are told to kill other people if they try to lead the nation into idolatry, if they are caught in the act of adultery. You're to kill them, stone them. Well, so how can the sixth commandment say do not kill when God is actually commanding to kill? Okay, so it's not kill, it's premeditated murder. It's murder which is the sixth commandment. Not just killing in every case. That would have a strong bearing on capital punishment, etc. So the command is not thou shalt not kill. A lot of times people throw that out. Well, you know, you're not even obeying your own laws, Christians, if you advocate for capital punishment. You need to understand the language there. And then just a consideration about New Testament soldiers. John the Baptist, Jesus, and Paul all spoke very directly to and of soldiers, even Christian soldiers, and none were instructed to resign their post. So just a piece of data from the New Testament. So with those theological considerations, let's just look at a couple of general considerations, just observation. One, evil exists. Therefore, evil aggression will exist. And one definition of good is to resist evil. If you don't resist evil when it's facing you, is that good? Okay. A second bullet point there is the purpose of this whole idea of just war or just peacemaking is not to legitimize or justify war. That's not the point. All other reasonable means should be exhausted first, but to bring war within the limits of justice. We want to bring a just war when necessitated by the prevalence of evil. And when we say war, we're also talking about maintaining order, such as what police officers do. Maintaining order, use the use of force if necessary to maintain order according to the limits of justice. The third bullet point there is we need to understand clearly just war, okay, waging a just war that a nation would wage, doesn't apply directly to individual citizens. Okay, someone is doing evil, the state will arrest them and execute them if necessary. That prerogative is not provided to the individual. Someone does evil to you, you cannot personally arrest them and execute them. That's not your prerogative. That's the prerogative of the state. Okay. So, what are the criteria that those who have considered the principles within Scripture that have put forward as far as the criteria for a nation declaring war? And generally, I would say, most what we would call Christian nations or nations influenced by Christianity have absorbed this kind of thinking before they declare war. So the wars in Europe that have been fought, both nations would uphold these kinds of things because of the Christian influence that has been there over the centuries. So here's the criteria for a nation declaring war to answer the question, why are we going to war? Because if a Christian's going to be involved, the just war theory says the war has to be just. We can't engage ourselves if we're just going to steal all those people's money, and that's why our nation is going to war. We must stand up as Christians and say, no, I'm not going to go fight with you in the army if that's your purpose. Okay. So what are the purposes for a just war? One, war must be the last resort. Okay, and there's some blanks there. You can fill them out as we go along. War must be the last resort after other means of restraining evil have failed. Okay. Again, what does the last resort mean? Well, that needs to be the purpose. That needs to be justified. That needs to be stated. This is the last resort. We've tried other means. They're not working. Two, a war must be declared officially by the proper head of state. Okay? So a portion of the citizenry can't say, we're going to war. Our nation is not, but we're going to. No. It must be the authorized head of state that declares openly, officially, that war. Okay, and that's why even today, our president and our Congress are always going back and forth. Are we going to officially declare war? And it must be declared officially. That's because in the kind of bedrock foundation of the Christian ethic that has, you know, influenced European and American governments is this idea of we must only declare just war. Because if we don't, all the Christians in our midst are going to stand up and say, ha, 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 you can't, we're not participating. So, number three, war must have a reasonable hope of success. It's not a just war if you just go out and you're going to get totally slaughtered. You're just slaughtering innocent lives of your own soldiers if you have no hope of success. The only exception that some have put forward is, unless the evil is so outrageous that the expense of the soldiers' lives must be offered as a protest against such evil. So, kind of a little bit of an exception there. Number four, wars hoped for good must be proportional to the destruction involved in achieving it. Okay. So proportional. So in other words, we're hoping to accomplish these ends. War in and of itself is going to cause this kind of destruction. Somehow those ought to be related. We can't engage in a war that will cost 10 million lives to save one life. The benefit gained is not proportional. Okay, so that has to be weighed. And again, a lot of this has to do with simply the ethic of life, the preciousness of life that we find in the scripture. Number five, war must be generally defensive / restorative in nature. Okay, in other words, we're responding to a wrong done. We're not just trying to increase our territory. We are responding to evil and we're seeking to restrain evil in the world. So it's defensive in nature. It's restorative in nature. They have invaded this country and taken over it illegitimately. We're seeking to restore proper peace to that area, etc. Number six, war must seek for a just and a lasting peace. That has to be the agenda. We're seeking for a just and a lasting, or at least hope for, as lasting as long as possible, peace. A just war is not engaged in for revenge, for conquest, for economic gain, or ideological triumph. Now, based on that alone, we have to step back a little bit, you know, and evaluate maybe the Gulf War engaged in the late 90s. We could probably take these criteria and evaluate the war in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq, etc., and ask, were these criteria met? And if we, depending on our understanding of those wars, some of these criteria might have been met, some of them might not have been met. There's some difficulty in evaluating on a national scale, why did we go to war? What were we trying to accomplish? And that's some of the difficulty, honestly, in our present day and age, even knowing why we're going to war, because that's not always truthfully and or widely disseminated. And sometimes governments have other motives besides the stated one. This is, again, where we're limited to some degree. Okay, and we'll talk about that. But let's talk about the just criteria for a nation conducting war, how they go about waging war. So if there's the reasons why they're declaring war, what are the ways in which they are conducting wars? How will the soldiers actually fight this war? And five criteria here. One, warriors must limit themselves to the primary objective, the restoration of peace. In other words, just because you're going to war doesn't mean you can do whatever you want while you're at war. Okay? police officers. Just because they're trying to establish peace doesn't mean they can treat someone however they want in the line of their duty. Okay, so limit themselves to the primary objective. Two, warriors must seek to incapacitate or restrain combatants whenever possible, not kill them or injure them unless necessary. Now, you may say, wait a minute. I thought the purpose of, having my weaponry and going out to battle, they're trying to kill me, I must kill them. If necessary, you must kill them. But if not necessary, better, again, based on the ethic of the preciousness of human life, better to merely restrain them or incapacitate them in some way, rather than to injure them or kill them. Yet, the future evil perpetrated by a merely restrained temporarily combatant, and then you let him go, and then he comes and does the evil again, has to be weighed in that mix. Okay. So this is a difficult one because, again, in modern day warfare, it is, when you're not necessarily in hand-to-hand combat, where you might overwhelm someone and then capture them, you're waging war many times from afar. And the only way to incapacitate them is to kill them. So, but it is still a principle that, as Christians, we should uphold. How will I wage war? Well, if possible, simply to capture someone or to incapacitate their military advantage would be a better option, again, because of the preciousness of life. Number three, warriors must not intentionally direct their attack on non-combatants, even as a means of gaining a military advantage, okay, or a military victory. Okay. Now, an exception would be in the extreme case in which the military good far outweighs the civilian harm. For instance, if you do any reading into how World War II ended, especially in the Pacific with the dropping of the bomb by Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the human casualties that were accomplished by those two bombs being dropped were far less than the anticipated, based on the history of the Pacific War, both of Japanese casualties and American and other casualties that were fighting against them. So in that case, that would serve as an exception. Less than 100,000 people were killed directly in those bombings, as opposed to 1 to 2 million people would suffer loss of life based on the stated Japanese resistance. They were all going to resist until every single one of them was killed. So, in other words, there was an intentional attack directed on the non-combatants in the dropping of those two bombs. Yet, the exception seem to be appropriate in that case because of the military good far outweighed the potential harm of civilians. But in general, soldiers ought to not attack non-combatants, even if it means they'll gain a military victory by doing so. That can't be the purpose. I'm going to attack non-combatants in order to gain a military advantage. What can happen is I'm going to attack a military target knowing that potentially there may be civilian casualties involved, yet it doesn't violate the principle of just war, knowing that potentially there would be civilians there. That's the nature, especially of modern war. Number four, warriors must seek to inflict no unnecessary suffering. Okay, and again, this is similar to number two. Just an example of what that might look like. In other words, the smallest size caliber bullet effective for the task must be used. You don't destroy things you don't need to destroy. You don't blow someone up if you can simply shoot them with a small caliber bullet, etc. Again, taking into account the preciousness of life. But as a general principle, we as warriors, we're not going to try to inflict suffering. That's not our goal. Our goal is to restrain evil, not to make evil people suffer. But the effectiveness of the task, and again, war is an ugly business, the effectiveness of the task needs to be taken into account. It's more effective to get the job done than to have to come back and do it again, etc. Number five, warriors must justify any indirect effect upon civilians as only what is necessary to repel the enemy combatants. So there's indirect effects on civilians at times. Their houses get destroyed. Was that justified to destroy that house? That needs to be weighed. And a lot of times that needs to be evaluated not only on a military strategist level, but also down to the individual soldiers fighting the battle also. The evil averted or the good attained must justify the action itself. Okay, so those are the criteria that have been put forward as those who have considered these matters. Here is how you engage in a just war with these five basic criteria. Just a couple of special considerations, I guess, that we ought to as we think about this. One is that history has shown that even wars entered into on just grounds and purposed to be fought by just means, they don't always stay that way. Sinful passions resident within individual humans and leaders means that when facing the great pressures of war, or sometimes police work, etc., it will take the utmost of self-control to restrain sinful actions in the midst of battles themselves. And not even all people that you are fighting together with will want to restrain themselves. They will want to give full vent to their passions during warfare. So this in and of itself has become a strong argument for some kind of limited pacifist type position. In other words, I would hold to a just war theory, some would say, if I lived in a non-sinful world. Of course, there wouldn't be war if we lived in a non-sinful world. But let's just say we're going to war and there's not this potential for people to give vent to their sinful passions and not engage in warfare in a just way, or for leaders to change the objective of the stated war in the middle and all of a sudden begin to engage in this war that was begun for just cause, now to has many unjust causes associated with it. This is a reason for Christians to say, you know what? I just don't know if we can engage in war, because this typically happens either in a small degree or large degree in the midst of warfare. That's a consideration that needs to be in our thinking, just the reality, not just of war, but of the human heart in the midst of war. Okay. Two, modern day individual soldiers don't always have the full knowledge of the objectives or even how they are going to be waging warfare, or even in the moment. How exactly are we waging warfare? I'm doing what my commanding officer is telling me to do, but I don't know exactly whether I'm keeping these criteria of just war or not. This is the difficulty of modern warfare, because often it's waged from a distance. It creates a real dilemma for the Christian soldier in determining if he should participate. I think clear communication of one's own morals and convictions with one's commanding officers is a good start, but certainly not foolproof. That might assist you in not violating your own moral convictions, but again, the commanding officer determines how it happens, and you follow orders in that situation. So it brings the question, do I want to put myself in that sort of situation in serving as a soldier? Sometimes we have the option to serve as a soldier. Sometimes in our nation we don't have the option and we are drafted to serve as a soldier. But if that is the case, do I consider warfare in general and what might happen? And do I simply say, I am a conscientious objector based on my religious convictions? Jesus said to turn the other cheek. I must take a pacifist position and not engage in warfare. Do we come to that position as a church? That's been the question for the church at large over the centuries, considering these things. Number three, another consideration is, because elements of every human war become unjust in the process of war, it behooves Christian civilians, in especially in democratic nations, to appeal and lobby and pressure their governments to strive for proactive peacemaking ventures. So let's take it out of the realm of the individual soldier at this point, and let's come back as civilians and say, since wars tend to go this direction, that put especially Christian soldiers in a great moral dilemma and may at some point cause us to have to stand up and say, I love my nation, but I cannot fight in that war because it's being engaged in this way or for this purpose. Let's, as Christian citizens, pressure, lobby, encourage our elected officials to not engage in war where possible. Where we can avoid war, let's seek to encourage peacemaking ventures until such time as evil must be restrained and the only option is war, and then encourage our elected officials to engage in such a war, but engage in it in a just way. And continually put that pressure on our heads of state, our lawmakers, etc., to make sure those things are in place. Because what we don't want to do, if we are not serving in the combat, is to stand back and say, well, I'm glad I don't have to make those decisions. But our sons and our loved ones are having to make those decisions, so let's do our part as Christian civilians to do what we can in the self-governing process that God has given us to put pressure such that we don't find ourselves in an unjust war, or we don't find our sons in an unjust war, or having to make these difficult moral decisions a lot of times when they really don't have all the facts to do it. We just know the nature of warfare itself. Well, just a few summary statements here, and then I'm going to open it for questions and clarifications. While our basic stance would be to turn the other cheek when being personally offended, and to seek the things which make for peace with all men, we don't find any specific biblical prohibition in Jesus' statement to turn the other cheek and other related passages that would prohibit a human government from inflicting capital punishment. As a matter of fact, it may in fact be unjust for human governments not to inflict capital punishment when it's due, based on some specific texts in Scripture. Two, governments, doesn't seem to be any biblical prohibition against governments declaring wars on another nation, or in the case of capital punishment, on individuals for a just cause. Three, there doesn't seem to be any biblical prohibition against serving as a soldier or serving as a civil officer that will need to use violence to restrain evil. There doesn't seem to be any biblical prohibition against defending oneself or one's family or a fellow citizen from a violent intruder, okay, one that's perpetrating violent evil on them. Turn the other cheek doesn't apply directly in those kinds of situations. Rather, there is a balancing sense in which I'm not seeking for personal revenge, someone seeking just to do me harm in a non-life-threatening way, if you will. They slap me on the cheek. They want to take my coat. Okay, look, I'm not trying to resist you in that sense that I'm going to go slap you. I'm going to take your coat and I'm going to take your wife's coat too. No, we don't take our own revenge. We let the Lord take care of those things. But when it comes to the upholding the value of life, there is a calling upon us to defend and restrain evil. Again, using these very same principles of restraining, doing what is necessary to restrain evil, someone who's trying to take another's life or do them terrible harm. Provided, okay, so there's no prohibition against those four things, provided the intent in doing so is pure, or maybe the best word there is just. The means of doing so are restrained to only what is necessary and allowably dignified, follows the criteria. Other reasonable solutions have been exhausted, and one's own conscience is not violated in this area of freedom. I think this is where we have to realize that different Christians will come to different positions on this whole issue. We've seen it's a difficult issue just walking through it. So we need to allow various Christians to hold different positions on this. Romans 14, let each man be convinced in his own heart. Don't violate your own conscience in this area.